From GPB News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. We'll step behind the scenes of TV and film today in a couple different ways. First, actor Tommy Davidson joins us to talk about some of the roles he's played in comedies like Black Dynamite and the sketch show In Living Color. And then we'll discuss one of the most iconic roles actors can tackle, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Native Atlantans likely remember the film The Boy King. Every year, WSB-TV would play the 1986 movie to coincide with Martin Luther King Day, which is Monday. Here's a scene from that movie with actor Walter Franks playing a teenage king.
Today I plead with you not to listen to that bitter, insulting voice of the segregationist, but listen to that strong, courageous voice of your heart, which cries out to us all. Lift every voice and sing to earth that heaven rings.
That's all coming up this hour. First, though, let's talk about what it means to have a dream. We heard from Jennifer Priestley yesterday. She's a statistician at Kennesaw State University, and she delivered mostly bad news about the odds of winning last night's big Powerball drawing.
You know, you hear people say, well, your probability of getting hit by an asteroid is better than your probability of winning the lottery. And there is some truth to that, to be perfectly honest.
Today we learned the big jackpot will be split three ways between winners in California, Tennessee, and Florida. But before the news broke, we asked how you would spend that millions or billion if you won here in Georgia. And here are your first thoughts.
This is Daniel. I'm a truck driver. I'm actually in Lithia Springs at the current moment. For the Powerball, I would spend it by first. I would tithe to my local church. Of course, donate quite a bit of it. And I would buy probably about 10 to 20 commercial trucks and start my own company.
Daniel also says he would pay off not only his own debts, but the debts of his loved ones. And for folks he doesn't like quite as much, he would give them a loan. We always love to hear what you think. You can call us at 404-500-9457. We're on Twitter at OSD Talk, or you can post to Facebook. We might feature your comments on the show. Tommy Davidson has spent the better part of his life as one of the most recognized entertainers in the business. His career is not just about stand-up comedy, but also for his work in films like the 2009 parody hit Black Dynamite.
Yep, that's right. I'm running things. I'm running things. Cream corn. That's why they call me that. Smooth. I got more measure for your pleasure.
Davidson also starred in the very influential sketch show In Living Color. He brought characters like self-proclaimed self-defense guru Sweet Tooth Brown to life.
My visually vicious yet totally painless attacks on this woman are but a metaphor for life. You got to watch your back.
Totally painless? You know nothing about karate.
Hey, and I never said I did. I'm a fight choreographer out of Hollywood.
That's right, you are.
Now Tommy Davidson is getting back to his stand-up roots. He'll perform at the Atlanta Comedy Theater tonight and tomorrow, and he joins us now. Good morning.
Thank you for playing those.
Does that bring back some memories?
I know them line for line.
Really?
Line for line.
Is that true of all the sketches?
All my stuff. I know everything line for line.
25 years on? That's an amazing
line
memory.
Line for line. I mean, it's just like it's locked in. It's locked in. I really appreciate it because... You know, sometimes I forget my skill set because this is a business.
Yeah.
So it's show business. It's like two parts. So in the song, it says, there's no business like show business. It's like no business I know.
Yeah.
Which makes it a unique business because it's split in two. There's a show and then there's dash business. Neither one of them have anything to do with each other. And they're interdependent at the same time.
A lot of entertainers are not good at the business side, though, and that can lead to some problems. Did you find that you had to learn how to do the whole business side?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because it's another vibration. It's another principle. You know, business is you get ahead no matter what you're doing. Creative is you give no matter what you're doing. So somehow they have to mix. So you got to find that balance. And
Did you ever worry about it, though? Because we see so many entertainers and you know, they reach incredible heights in terms of success and fame, and then they're filing for bankruptcy and selling their homes, and everyone's wondering what happened to all that money. Did you ever worry?
I worried, but I always have been able to be – I've always been surrounded with good people that help guide me, you know? And I think one of the things about my personal success in that arena is that I've been able to stay absorbent and malleable about new information.
What's that mean?
That means if someone tells me something, to shut my mouth and listen, and then to actually put it into action. And it's tough to do. It's a skill.
I read that you interned at a radio station for a semester when you were in college. So we almost got you, my industry.
You have me. You have me. I was thinking the first thing I do with the $1 billion is buy this station and then ask you what you wanted to do with your show. Because I know that that's the key to success. I know, but I didn't play Powerball. So. But when it comes around, you know, because you can see that's pretty a realistic parallel for success is to allow people to do what they do. And then that'll come around. It's part of the universal law of exchange. Give with an open hand, receive with an open hand. You know, you saw it with who's the Apple dude?
You mean Steve Jobs?
Yeah. You saw it with him or Milton Hershey or Conrad Hilton or anybody that has had that type of success understands that who you set up around you has to be able to do what they do 100% to give a return.
You know, I wonder, to go back to, we were just hearing that sketch on In Living Color, and I used to watch that all the time.
I like that sketch. That's one of my favorites.
So I wonder what, you're now back to doing stand-up, which can be a lonely, it's just you and your jokes and your words up there. How different is that to doing sketch stuff where you're bouncing off other people's energy?
It's a tightrope act. No, you're up there by yourself with the pole, but it's beautiful because it's you and you guide your own movement. It's you who makes the moves. It's an individual sport. It's not a team sport.
Yeah, but there's nobody there to catch you. I mean, going back to tightrope, there's nobody there the net.
Oh, yeah. You're right about that. And that's where that skill set comes in. You know, learn how to swim. Learn how to swim. Learn how to fish. Like all those basic things, learn how to do them so that you can walk through life on your own. But there is the collaborational part of life, you know, that blend. And improv is that. So once you learn how to be interdependent of others and learn, like I learned how to be a straight man. Of all the things in the world, I learned how to be a straight man from sketch. I learned how to make things funny being the straight man in the sketch. Like Abbott and Costello or Sonny and Cher or Laurel and Hardy or Fred and Barney. Worked because
Fred Barney from the Flintstones, yeah.
Right, because they worked because they had two roles. One was the funny guy and one was the straight guy, but they both were comedy. So I learned how to do that, which expanded everything for me. So I can, like, if you look at it in Living Color in its totality, you'll see me in a lot of roles with major comedy sketches. I was always the guy with Jamie and the ugly woman. I was always the guy with Jim in Fire Marshal Bill.
Jim Carrey.
I was always the other guy in the sketch, which is like the best metaphor I can bring to bear now is basketball. It's like you always look at the guy with the ball, but there's four other dudes. It's learning how to play without the ball.
But how do you also learn how, I mean, especially with somebody like Jim Carrey, mm-hmm. whom even people who have worked with him has talked about his energy as just being sort of overwhelming in your face.
Yeah.
How do you not lose focus completely to that kind of...
I mean, you know, ask the players who play with Jordan. You know, ask the players who play with Jordan. But Jordan, you know... Michael Jordan. When you look at Michael Jordan's career, he came from North Carolina, which is a very disciplined system. He went from there to Phil Jackson's coaching the triangle system, which was inherited from some basketball mathematics systems that had been put in place a long time ago. And that system includes a shooter. So in that system is designed so one player can be the major shooter. He transformed that system and took it to the Lakers. And Kobe was the shooter. You see?
Yeah.
And so you connect all the championship.
Not anymore.
Yeah. But you connect all the championship rings. He has 11 rings.
Yeah.
But it's the system. It's almost like Lombardi.
Or
the guy Brown of the Cleveland Browns. Bringing in that rudimentary.
And that's how you think of, we're talking about two different things. In a sketch show where you found yourself playing in a support role and supporting the mm-hmm. team, mm-hmm. and then now your stand-up where you are the team, mm-hmm. it's just you. Is that a completely different, could you do both of those things at the same time, or are they just not?
I can do both of those things at the same time. But it's just being able to it's a part of mastery. It's a part of mastery. And mastery has to do with being able to understand different components and the relationship between them.
And what your role is.
And then being able to execute them based on your role at the time.
I wanted to talk, we have like 3 minutes left and I could talk for a long time. I know. Oh, he's glaring at my producers. It's not their fault. So I wanted to talk about Sammy Davis Jr., which is one of your more well-known impressions. Although you do
Thank
a bang
you. You
up
know, since I know I only
Obama
have 3 minutes,
impression.
I can definitely do that for about 30.
But I understand you actually got the rights to the book Deconstructing Sammy and creating a serious movie about his life is one of your future projects.
It is. It is, and it's something that I'm just gonna ride that horse all the way across the old West, because it is a natural role for me.
Yeah.
And I'm just gonna keep doing this until it comes around.
Is your attraction to Sammy because you do the impression so well, or is there something about him that you just aren't like and are engaged by?
It's totally him. He's the most talented entertainer of all time. Hands down. And Frank Sinatra can tell you that, you know, and anybody who is in the business for as long as he was can tell you that. And that has to do with who he was. He was a kid that grew up on the vaudeville circuit and the Chitlin circuit back then, and then was a child of entertainment all the way through and broke racial barriers for all entertainers and could do everything. We were talking about mastery. He could do everything to that level. So he tapped on a level that was out of this world. So he was one of the best tap dancers. He sang on a level that was way ahead of everybody that was doing it.
He was also quite funny.
He was funny, a comedian, too.
Yeah.
A drummer, a gunslinger.
Gunslinger?
A gunslinger. He actually started Clint Eastwood's career by teaching him how to gunsling and got him his first role on the Western. Was best friends with Elvis. Was best friends with Marilyn Monroe, Sam Cooke, Muhammad Ali. I mean, so he crossed all these social barriers, but yet he was a great entertainer too. So who wouldn't want that role?
So do you think, we have a minute left here, as you get ready for your comedy shows tonight in Atlanta, do you think of yourself as an impressionist? Do those impressions come in?
Yeah. I think of myself as a complete entertainer like him. So when it comes to comedy, I do a little bit of everything. I do political satire. I do impressions. I do improv at the moment. I've been able to achieve on stage what Bruce Lee was able to achieve with his martial arts career. He said, of a question that was asked of him in 1968 on a radio interview, he was asked, how did you become such a great martial artist? He said, I train myself so constantly that my moves become reflex, but they're not natural because I had to train myself to react that fast. So what I experience in martial arts is a natural unnaturalness or an unnatural naturalness. And that's what I experience now on stage.
Tommy Davidson, he'll perform at the Atlanta Comedy Theater, a total of 5 shows, both tonight and tomorrow. It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
5 shows.
This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee.
We all been locked up a long time now.
Yeah.
Not just on the inside of a jail, but on the outside of it as well.
Yeah, right.
And I'm saying to you this morning, we're not going to take it anymore.
No.
I'm saying to you this morning, we're not going to take it anymore.
That's right.
We're not going to take it anymore. Praise God.
That is Clifton Powell in the role of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That's a play part that many actors have played, most recently, of course, David Oyelowo in Selma. Our understanding of MLK is partly shaped by these cinematic portrayals, but do we get an accurate picture of the actual civil rights leader that these performances are meant to portray? Joining me now are some people who've given this a little bit of thought. We have Stephanie Dunn. She's the director of cinema, television, and emerging media studies at Morehouse College. And we also have Gerald Durley. He was pastor for many years at Providence Missionary Baptist Church in Atlanta and knew Dr. King. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
You're nodding. We're on radio. So I wonder if you let me start with you, Gerald, and tell me a little bit about what characters' personal characteristics struck you the most when you're talking to Dr. Klinger, spending time with him. How would you then describe him to other people?
Well, in my particular case, first of all, thank you for having us on the show. I started when I was 18 years old in Nashville, Tennessee. That was 1960, 55 years ago, or 56 years ago now. I was a freshman and getting involved in the movement back then with C.T. Vivian and all of us. And the thing that struck me most when they came into Nashville, having been a student leader at Tennessee State, was the fact that he was very humble. He had a sense of humor. He was open. But again, I had to realize this, that he was only a few years older than us. No movements have ever been done by old people. They were young people. So Andy was 28 years old. And so Andrew Young was only 28. So he was there around, like, I think 30 years old or something like that. So he could speak with us, but he was never overbearing. He never tried. One of the things that we didn't understand then, but we understand now, he never tried to take the movement away from the young people at Tennessee State and Fisk and those of us there. He was always supportive all the way through from the bus boycott. He was a supportive person. He did not clamor to be leader. He was put in that position, and he accepted it nobly.
Stephanie, you know, I went back and watched a whole bunch of excerpts of people playing Martin Luther King, and I'll have to tell you, his youth, you don't often see on film. People are often portraying him with the gravitas of an older person, and the style of speaking they use is the style of speaking you might hear him using when he's giving a sermon or a speech, and I have to imagine he didn't speak that way in real life.
Well, I've said before that one of the challenges, I think, to portraying King in film is getting those personal nuances. It's not so much the speeches. I think that people, a really extraordinarily good actor, can listen so much to the speeches and kind of get the sort of oral cues of that. But I think it's portraying him in those intimate moments when you're supposed to be portraying the personal King with his intimates, when he's just having a good time and you're trying to capture the nuances of his humor. I would think that is the challenging, I think, the other challenging part as an actor of trying to portray King in a way that's sort of more holistic, other than when he's just on the public stage and he's making the great speeches. Exactly.
I want to play you a clip from the 2014 film Selma, which showed a side of Dr. King that we don't often see, and that's his flawed side. In the movie, this is an exchange between King, played by David Oyelowo, and Coretta Scott King, played by Carmen Ejogo.
If I ask you something, will you answer me with the truth?
Yes.
Because I'm not a fool. Do you love me?
Yes, I love you, Coretta.
Do you love any of the others?
No.
I wonder, do you often worry that in the attempt to play all the aspects of Dr. Martin Luther King, that it's difficult in a film to show this flawed person and not lose some of the admiration we have for him?
I think so, because so many times when you have a person that's been built up as an icon and a model in the African-American community, we it's very difficult for a filmmaker to try. We would criticize that person if they showed him off smoking or out taking drinking or saying about other. We from the community would say, why would they show that side? Why do they tear down our icons? So a lot of times it's a very complex situation to portray that. I think one of the most comical times was the day that he was killed, the night that he was killed, the big pillow fight. I've never heard it. I've seen it portrayed that occurred in the Lorraine Motel that night when Andy didn't get back for the garbage workers' strike. And a pillow fight broke out in the hotel, and he was in the middle of feathers flying everywhere, laughing and clowning. And a few hours later, he was dead. That's the real sensitive part. But do you portray that? Would it make him seem somewhat of a frivolous character who— And I think that's a challenge that filmmakers and others, when portraying Dr. King, with those who knew him, saw him as a very fun-loving guy, laughing, and a humanitarian. First of all, he was a father, and second of all, he was a gospel preacher.
I want to play for you, Stephanie, a scene from the 1978 series King, which starred Paul Winfield. And in this scene, you hear Dr. King delivering a sermon. There's a huge congregation. This is right after a white man got on stage and punched him.
Ask yourself what it would be like if you were taught since you were a child, since you were baby enough to crawl, that the Negro is a thing, if you had been taught by your parents, by your teachers, yes, even the preachers and the people sitting next to you in church, that it's not wrong to hate, and what would you be then?
When you're choosing, I mean, when you're listening or watching a portrayal of Dr. Martin Luther King, what things are you looking for?
You know, I'm not sure that I'm looking for anything as much as I'm expecting to be taken in and seduced in a way to forget that this is an actor portraying King. Because with any role, even of a real person, what we're looking for is to believe, right, that that is that person for the space of the time that that movie
Willing suspension
exactly.
of disbelief.
So in other words, of course, we're going to notice if there's something outstanding that doesn't seem to gel with this very popularized, right, sort of image of the person, right? But mostly what we're expecting is that we forget that this person is indeed interpreting and portraying King, because we're supposed to believe in that moment, in that time of that 2 hours or whatever it is, that this is Dr. King.
Now, that's a different standard, Stephanie, for you than it is for somebody like Dr. Durley, who knew Dr. King, because you're talking about just having belief in that person's portrayal, which doesn't mean historically accurate completely.
Yeah, but then again, I think back to the point you were raising with him earlier. Really, what we haven't seen yet with Dr. King is a real biopic, sort of motion picture sort of biopic of Dr. King. That really actually hasn't happened yet. What we've seen are more portrayals that are in relation specifically to different parts of the movement. There really hasn't been. Even Selma is, right?
It's about
that
event. Yeah.
So we haven't yet really seen quite a lot of actual motion picture sort of treatments that actually are undertaking to do the life of Dr. King. And then I would think that we would see more of the complexities of him. And maybe then if we saw that, we wouldn't have to substitute sort of like the iconic sort of noble legacy for the other part of portraying a complex character. But we're portraying him mostly so far in relation to the movement. Not necessarily are these registering or intended to be biopic sort of, you know, treatments of Dr. King.
She's exactly right. See, I think, and going back to what would be so important, to show Dr. King when he was speaking with his daddy. Daddy King was a very powerful man. You had William Holmes Borders down the street. There was a competition between Ebenezer and Wheat Street, and Martin was growing up in that. He was only 16 when he went to Morehouse. What does a 16-year-old kid do but conversations about between he and Dr. Mays, who was his mentor, who was president of Morehouse College, the times when he felt disappointed. Only one time I've ever seen portrayed when Coretta looked at him and said, "You're kind of short." And that kind of thing, and those human aspects. He was a child, and he was going through 16, and then before going up to Boston. Those are the aspects that set the foundation before he went down into Alabama. The MIA, when it was formed, I don't know if that's ever been portrayed, Stephanie.
Yes,
maybe you can help me.
No, sir.
He did not want to even lead the MIA. He was at home, and the people voted him in because he was the youngest preacher in the city, and the black preachers didn't want to take the responsibility. So they said, let's go get that young boy who just came here, who's 26 years old, took him to the meeting and said, you are now the president of the Montgomery Improvement Association, and we want to start a boycott. He had a full life ahead of him. Those are the things. What decisions did he say, all right, I'll take this, and I'll go ahead? 366 days later, here he was in the movement. The rest is history, 13-year period.
Yes,
but
yeah.
What are the nuances and the psychological, emotional challenges that this man had to go through?
His grandfather, A. King, an amazing radical figure.
Exactly.
And with his own mother, very little screen portrayals ever. I can't even remember really the scenes just with in terms of that family, his
dynamic.
His sister, his brother, with his mother, who, you know, also was assassinated, was killed.
Playing the Lord's
Prayer.
Those
are missing in the cinematic treatment so far.
Well, let's bring another voice into this. We have actor Clifton Powell joining us. He actually played the role of Martin Luther King Jr. for the TV movie Selma, Lord Selma. It aired in 1999. Clifton, it's an honor to have you.
I'm glad to be a part. How's everybody today?
Fine. How
are
you doing?
How are you, sir?
Clifton, I wanted actually to play you a scene from that 1999 film where you played the role of MLK. Take a listen.
each one of you needs to look into your heart. Decide whether you want to carry on with this march.
We go on.
We go on.
I'm telling you right now, we're not going to let any cross burning stop us. We're not going to let any hatred stop us. We're not going to let nothing turn us around.
No, sir.
We're moving on.
So Clifton,
that certainly brings back memories, I tell you.
Can you tell me a little bit about your process and what kind of things you were looking to get inside the head of this man?
Well, I think it's what the panel said. I don't think there's ever been a real accurate portrayal of Dr. King. I think we see just one slice of Dr. King's life, the slice that led the movement. And it was so many other dimensions. Again, going, you know, being involved in the movement and going to Morehouse at 16. I mean, and then leaving to go out to Boston, being called in as the youngest pastor, his family life, his connection to his family, his dad, his mom, his connection to Coretta, his kids. You know, I think we often get one-dimensional portrayal of Dr. King. He was a jokester. He liked to have fun with the guys. I mean, you know, I don't know if you saw in that episode, I smoked cigarettes every now and then. He smoked cigarettes and wore his glasses. And so what I really tried to do as an actor was really try to just get the soul of the man, because, you know, the script was, you know, again, a slice of his life as Dr. King in the movement. And so what I also did was I just briefly went back to Eye on the Prize and tried to see some other snippets and other dimensions of Dr. King. And then as an actor, I just try to do the truth and just, you know, take the words off the page and try to find his humanity in his heart.
Did you watch film of him and recite along with him, speak his speeches along with him?
No, you know, as an actor, I'm trained in dialect. You can go into an African accent if I want to, or, you know, you can go into a Southern accent, or, you know, studying Eyes on a Prize, because of my theater training, I just really tried to capture Dr. King's tones and his inflections, the bottom of his voice. And I just studied that. I think I probably stayed up all night long just trying to get the tenor and in a different levels of his voice, which is not easy to do. But God has, you know, blessed me, you know, with, you know, good training. That's what I call it.
Can you still go back? Can you still kind of hearken back to your Martin Luther King role?
Oh, yeah. When I went into audition, I did a snippet of his last speech. I think it goes like this. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. And I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and he has allowed me to go up to the mountaintop. And I've looked over. So that's just a little piece of it. But it's all just, you know, training and placement of the voice and, you know, breath control and all of that stuff that Dr. King did naturally, and us as actors try to go in and capture, you know? So that's, you know, a part of my training.
So Stephanie, I want to play for you a clip from the 2001 film Boycott, which included Jeffrey Wright as Martin Luther King Jr. And this is a performance you also particularly like.
The first sin I've committed is being born a Negro. The second sin I've committed, along with all of us, is to object to the twin battering rams of segregation and oppression.
What do you like about that?
Well, for one thing, I think what I liked so much about that is that Jeffrey Wright just did a really fine job, I think, of doing what Clifton was referencing with trying to find some of those nuances throughout his portrayal.
The humanity.
I mean, we see some of those off the stage moments. I mean, you get those in every single film movie. But I always look for those sort of when he's not speaking officially moments, and see what kind of, you know, sort of gestures and just cues when he's not, quote, on stage within the film. And I think that Jeffrey Wright, as well as Clifton, in a lot of the performances that I've seen, Clifton's, Paul Winfield's, those are the moments that I think that many of these fine actors have done a really wonderful job with. And I would have loved to see more of them them those seeing.
Yeah, you're waiting for a real biopic.
Exactly.
That is Morehouse College. Professor Stephanie Dunn. We also spoke with Clifton Powell, who played Martin Luther King Jr. in the 1999 television film Selma, Lord Selma. And of course, Gerald Durley, who was pastor for many years at Providence Missionary Baptist Church in Atlanta and knew Dr. King personally. Thanks to all three of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very
Honored.
Much.
Thank you.
And don't you never, ever, ever let it go. 'Cause in your hands is a promise, my land. Little boy, King, keep your dream close to your heart. Little boy, King, keep your dream. And don't you never.
I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. A very famous house is on the market.
Welcome to the Playboy Mansion.
The five-acre residence of Playboy magazine founder Hugh Hefner is up for sale. $200 million. For that, you get 20,000 square feet, bragging rights, and your very own legendary Playboy. 89-year-old Hefner will continue to live in the mansion despite new ownership. Sound like a good deal? We're going to talk about it tomorrow in the break room, but let's get your help in kicking off this conversation. Would you take that deal if you had $200 million sitting around? Call us at 404-500-9457, and then be sure to join us tomorrow at 9 a.m. 500 students from around Georgia gathered in Athens over the weekend for a chess tournament, but the event was about much more than chess. Athens nonprofit Chess and Community hosted the event. It uses the game as a tool to teach at-risk youth critical thinking skills to help them succeed in life. Producer Linda Chen stopped by the tournament and brings us this audio postcard.
Are we ready to begin, ladies and gentlemen?
The game of chess is a mirror of life. My name is Lemuel LaRoche, also known as Life the Griot in the Athens community. I'm the executive director of Chess and Community.
The game may begin.
So the motto for Chess and Community is think before you move. Think before you engage. Think before you speak. And the whole idea is to help kids use that framework to make better decisions, inform decisions, teach them how to respond to a situation rather than reacting to a situation.
White moves first, so I'm going black.
So I decided that every kid that I would work with through the juvenile system, I decided that I would teach them how to play chess. And in doing so, I saw how it began to change their minds, their behavior, and even how they perceive themselves. Because at one point they were like, oh man, you guys, it's too much thinking, until they got really comfortable in that thinking, and they began to apply some of the strategies they learned on the chessboard in life. For instance, I would play a game with a kid, and the kid would just move, and I said, I could tell you start things, but you don't finish. And they're like, how you know? You show that in how you play.
You're going down.
I'm what?
You're going down fast.
Emma.
What I try to do as a way to engage them or to get them, to lure them into the game, is I identify how each piece on the chessboard correlates with something they see within their day-to-day life. So I start with the pawn, you know, because the pawn is me and you, the day-to-day people, the people that gotta keep society moving. So I teach them how the pawns represents their friends. Make sure that you choose the friends that can guide you in the right direction. But most important, don't be used as a pawn to advance somebody's negative agenda. You know, I mean, at some point, we all are pawns on somebody's chessboard, but the objective is to not allow yourself to be misused, not allow somebody to take you and have you on the street somewhere, and before you know it, you end up incarcerated. Then I show them how it works in society. How do you utilize these resources around you to make better choices and to become better informed in where you want to go and how you want to go and how far you want to go in life?
My name is Joshua Diakompuna. I'm a seventh grader, and I am a part of the Classic City Knights. Favorite piece on the chessboard would have to be the queen, because the queen moves all around, and the queen, not only can it capture, but it could also help out other pieces. Knowing that can help me get ways to avoid or discontinue myself with these people that are trying to get me sucked in to gang life, trying to talk to me about it. Just to avoid myself, stay closer to good friends, and even tell my teacher sometime, like, this person is talking about this and that, and maybe even try to help them myself.
So the ABCs of chess are A, activate, that means get these pieces.
There's always something I can do to help myself win. And once I know there's always something to do that I can help myself win, I don't get stressed out, I don't get angry, and I stay calm.
Anyway, you can go here, that move, you can go there.
Oh, okay.
So now this one, the bishop.
I've seen a lot of kids say when they began to implement some of the things that we've been teaching them, they start to see a change in their lives and in their behavior. Now, of course, poverty is real. Poverty is a real situation, and oftentimes the poverty, it breeds desperation, it breeds different conditions and environments, and these kids have to grow up in these conditions. So teaching them the game, and now that they have a tool to think critically through a situation rather than react to a situation, a lot of times you see positive outcomes from it.
I got you. Checkmate. Thank you.
You can learn more about chess and community at chessandcommunity.org. Also, stop by our Facebook page. Check out photos from that event. They're at facebook.com/onsecondthoughtradio. Chess has been used for decades to try and bridge that gap, the success gap between at-risk kids and other kids. Here to explain why this game appeals to urban youth is Paul Hoffman. He's the president and CEO of the Liberty Science Center in New Jersey. Hi there, Paul.
Hi, how are you?
It's good to have you on. I lived in Montclair for a number of years, so I can say personally the Liberty Science Center is a cool place.
Oh, wonderful. Thank you.
It's nice to have you. You know, I wonder, can we start with just how complicated chess is? Because it has a reputation for being an intellectual's game. And yet I find that a lot of the games my teenage son plays seem way more complex with using a lot more math than chess does. Does chess deserve its high IQ reputation?
Yeah, I mean, chess has a reputation in our culture, not just in the United States, but elsewhere. It's a game that is a sign of intellectual ability if you're good at it. Chess is a very specific kind of intelligence that doesn't necessarily translate into other things. Chess players have, and when I mean chess players, I'm talking about people that play it at the highest levels, people that make their living by playing in tournaments. I mean, they have incredible memories for chess positions. But psychologists that have studied their memories find that their memory is no better than your or my memory of non-chess things. So it is, yes, there are certain abilities, I think, that you need to be very strong at chess. The kind of visualization that being able to see things in your mind's eye that mathematicians would have, that architects would have, that people in some other professions would have. But the thing about chess is, and the reason why the game is so popular and has been around with the rules barely changing for over 1,500 years, is that it's so accessible to so many people. And the reputation of chess as being a game of intellectuals shouldn't stop people from getting involved. Because the thing about chess, and I've taught people at all levels, from 80-year-old adults that don't know how to play to 3-year-olds, and the thing about chess is that you see yourself getting better very quickly. That things that you couldn't understand and seem totally befuddling about how the pieces interact, that the next week when you play, suddenly you see this kind of clarity. And that's very empowering to people. And it's the only game I can think of, or sport, if you can call it a sport, where if a 5-year-old sits down to play an 80-year-old, they can have a good game and the outcome is in doubt. You know, 5 and an 80-year-old aren't going to go out and play one-on-one basketball or hit the golf course, but they
hopefully
can play
not
a game of chess together. And it's an incredible game for, for youth. There are programs, particularly in urban centers in the United States, where now you teach chess to everybody in school,
right,
in second or third grade.
Now, I want to stop you there because you just said you teach chess to everybody in school. Now, if I list off the top of my head the chess masters that I know,
yes.
Kasparov, Karpov, who else do I know? Bobby Fischer, of course, maybe Capablanca. There isn't a female among them. This is another reputation that chess has for being something that we teach to boys. Is that fair?
I mean, it has changed a lot. When I, and, you know, I'm in my late 50s, I played in the junior high school championship when I was in junior high school. There were like 400 kids, one girl, and 399 boys. If you went to a chess
tournament... How was she? Wait, how was she?
She's good. She beat me.
Girl power.
She was very good. Girl power, exactly. And but if you went to the junior high school championship today, 15% of the players would be female. So that's not great. It's not 50%, but it's a hell of a lot better than 1 in 400. And that's because we're now teaching chess universally to both boys and girls. And this is what the Soviet Union used to do. So when after the chess was always popular back in the days of the czars, but then once the communists took power, chess was taught to everybody in the Soviet Union. They believed that it built the mind the same way that exercise built the body. And there are lots of very strong female players because everybody had access to it. It just here, somehow we fell into this, I don't know exactly how, that, you know, chess is something that fathers taught to their sons and not their daughters. But, you know, that is changing. And there's a woman that I work with, Judith Polgar. She's Hungarian. She's the top female player in the world. And she got to the number 7 position on the scale of men and women. So she's darn good at number 7 in the world. But it's a wonderful, wonderful game for young kids to take up because it helps you. I mean, it's very interesting because I have taught lots of 5-year-olds to play. And the first thing somebody does when they play chess is you fall in love with your own moves. It's like, I can attack the guy's king, and you quickly do it. And then you don't think about that. You don't put yourself in the other person's shoes and go, okay, how would they respond? And maybe they have some crushing response. So one of the things that chess teaches you is that there's an other, that there's somebody who can react to what you do. So it teaches a lot of social skills, too, you know, not to be a cocky winner, not to, you know, be able to bounce back from losses and not let it destroy you.
Well, then let's talk about why this is chess has been used, and I mean for decades, has been used in especially inner school, inner city schools. Mm-hmm. To a certain extent, I can understand it because chess is not expensive. You don't have to build a basketball court. You don't have to have a swimming pool. You just have to sit down to the board and some pieces, which can cost you $9 at Target. But to another extent, it's hard to imagine because chess is so removed from the daily life of many of these kids that live in these very, very tough places. And you're sitting down with a game that is silent. You know, there's not a lot of excitement.
I think there are two things about it. One is it's incredibly absorbing. So one of the reasons I love to play chess is that when I'm playing it, I'm in the moment. And whatever else is happening in my life recedes, and I'm totally caught up in that game. So, you know, any problems in the rest of my life, I get to put on hold during that moment.
So it's an escape.
It's a good escape. It's an escape that builds the mind. But the other thing is, it's a highly competitive activity. So not only does it exercise your mind, but it gets out those really competitive juices. I mean, there are programs in New York and some of the, you know, arguably worst schools, meaning, and by that I mean not just there are schools where there's a fair amount of violence in the community. And you have kids that stay after school for 3 or 4 hours, 300 or 400 of them in some of these high schools, filling an entire auditorium with people going at it at the chessboard. This is a pretty healthy way to get out one's, you know, competitive aggressions in one way, to do it healthily over the chessboard and not in a back alley.
Do you think it's also a way? Now, there have been some chess scandals. Recently, of course, we had the scandal where a 25-year-old chess player last year was accused of hiding a cell phone in the bathroom and using it to cheat. So I'm wondering what kind of sense of honor you teach kids because, everyone's carrying a cell phone. It can't be that hard to cheat.
Sure. Well, I mean, it's this, you know, those, that kind of cheating takes place occasionally in, you know, official tournaments where people can win prizes, as it does in any sport. I mean, unfortunately now, if you look at whether it's soccer, whether you look at bicycling, whether you look at steroid use in football, to look at what the top athletes do is not always the best role model for our children. And unfortunately, chess is not immune to that.
Although I doubt there's a whole lot of steroid use in chess. Nobody, you know, there's not a lot of pressure for a chess player to take steroids.
There's not a lot of pressure for a chess player to take steroids, but certainly at the highest levels, there have been issues with, occasionally, with, you know, players taking substances to keep their minds more active,
alert,
to keep them more alert, things like that. Those substances are banned, as they are in sports. So, you know, that's, it's not been the issue in chess that it's been in other sports. But the ease with which it's possible to cheat with, you know, having databases of opening moves on your cell phone, that kind of thing, has been an issue at the highest levels.
Yeah, it absolutely. And before we go, can you explain to me what things you think chess helps with? In other words, are we talking about a game that feeds your mathematical capabilities? Does it only feed your analytical capabilities?
I think it helps with your ability to concentrate. I think it helps with your ability to plan ahead. I think it helps with your ability to come back from defeat. And I don't mean just when you lose a game, but chess takes a while. And then a piece of a chess game is often I get an advantage and I'm trying to push that advantage and turn it into a win. And then I make an inaccurate move and suddenly the position's even, or maybe you have the advantage. That psychologically is hard for me to adjust to, that for the last hour I had been winning and now I'm not. But you need to be able to deal in the moment and recalibrate your thinking, and that's not so easy. But that skill is very useful in other aspects of our life.
Yeah. That's Paul Hoffman. He's president and CEO of the Liberty Science Center in New Jersey. Thank you so much, Paul.
Thank you very much.
And of course, he didn't mention it, but you do get to use all kinds of cool phrases like the Benko Gambit and the Albin Counter Gambit. You know, there's lots of cool terms in chess. Anyway, that is our show for today. Tomorrow, the Breakroom Gang meets again. They're going to talk about a new lawsuit. The plaintiff in that suit wants the federal government to remove the motto, "In God We Trust," from its money. So what do you think? Is having "In God We Trust" on our money and perhaps "Under God" in our Pledge of Allegiance a violation of the separation of church and state? Call us with your opinion, 404-500-9457, or tweet us or post on Facebook. Our show is produced by Linda Chen, Taylor Gant, and Sean Powers. Our senior producer is Lindsay Foster Thomas. Our engineer is Jacob Bokey. Tanya Ott is the VP of radio, and our theme music is Silent Machine from Georgia's own Cat Power. For today, that is On Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great day.